So, where's everybody from? Are people local? Are they from other countries? Or who's not from America? Wow. Who's from San Francisco? Oh, lots. Lots, yeah. Me. Hey, thanks for sticking around. We need a volunteer from the audience, but it's not going to be anything. Just volunteer, and then I'll let you know what the task is. Okay. Can you run the slide projector?
Is this like Friday?
So there's just a button that'll just help you move things forward. Or there's no remote. No. There's just like a button forward. So I think these guys were here. Dan and Jan. They live in Bakersfield, California. And I met them in the middle of this project that I was working on. And to give you a little brief on the project, I live in San Francisco. I work as a photographer. And an assignment I got once was to photograph this guy who invented this new kind of foosball table. So it was like a game that would be in an office environment, kind of just like foosball or pool. And the guy was an inventor, and he was just kind of fascinating. And he was so obsessed with this thing and so proud of it. And he did it in his garage, and I saw how it affected, his family and his wife, and he kind of took over the whole space and was so focused on this. And I was like, boy, it'd be neat if I could try to do a little project on a bunch of independent inventors. And so, you get in the computer and you type in inventor and you start poking around. And I came across like a kind of a little web listserv type of thing for inventors of sex machines. Let's go to the next slide. And this is like you could play with the focus a little bit too. You kind of know when it's in focus and when it's not. But it's, and just the idea, for me at least, the idea of like a sex machine was almost like someone said, I have a time machine and I want you to come over and photograph it. Like I couldn't really picture what exactly these things were and what the idea was. But, here on this listserv, I got this little view into, these inventors who were passionate and they were kind of sharing little details and photographs of these machines they invented. And they had snapshots of their machines, and I looked at their snapshots, and it would be like this. And all these photos were made by me, but it was almost like, they would take their machine and stick it in a very mundane domestic place, like on their kitchen table, and you could see a baby's crib in the background and kids' report card. And I was just like, oh man, if I could make photos that were like that, I'd be really happy. And so I kind of went off to replicate those types of pictures, but here's just kind of an introductory photograph. This is one of a sex machine a guy was making, and he was outside of Los Angeles, and his deal was, he's like, you can come over and interview me and photograph my machine, but you can't photograph me, And I was like, went over and took the risk, but was immediately, satisfied when I saw this. And it's like he just spray painted it silver. It wasn't like this chrome thing. It was just spray painted to look better than it really was. But let's move on to the next machine. And kind of like when I discovered these sex machines, we're poking around different places and trying to meet inventors, and I couldn't meet any. But I came to the guys who own this place, but it wasn't called kink.com. It was called something else, Cybernet Entertainment. And they had. I was trying to work for sell a story on what they were up to a magazine. And I photographed, this at their old studio. And this was a machine made out of a Mixmaster. And I thought it was so funny and so humorous. And, the thing was neat and the studio environment was neat. But I'm making these photographs and I thought they were missing something. And I thought that they were missing a human element. And it's like, here we're in a porn studio and pornography wasn't interesting to me because I thought pornography was theater, and it wasn't really about real people's lives. It was this fabricated, like photographing a play or something. But, these things were made by real people, and they were made for real people to use. And I thought if I could, look at these photographs in a real people's life, the result would be richer or more human or more kind of sensational maybe because it was so shocking, but then in this comforting environment. And so that, after kind of playing around with the project a little bit, I realized that I needed those two things. I needed the familiar and then the kind of the thing that looks like it came out of your id or something like that, your darkest sexual desire or nightmare or something like that. So let's go to the next slide. So I went off to try to reach people who were making these machines and these inventors. And I guess in my head, I thought it said a lot about men and women and you know, originally I thought the things were kind of ridiculous because I thought it seemed like a man's idea of what a woman would want, you know. And a lot of times I'd interview these guys and the guy would say, "Oh, I made it for my wife, and you know, she told me to go fuck myself. I would never touch, you know, she would never touch the thing." But you know, then I started to sell it on eBay or something like that, you know. And so there was just this kind of like disparity between like the wants and needs. But around the time, you know, I was going off to interview people, I started to try to interview people over the internet first, you know, before I went to visit them. And this one guy sent me this email that was just so, I thought it cut to the chase of this whole thing. And he said, "I've been building things all my life. When the topic comes up that I'm working on a sex machine, people start to say I have problems. My wife makes me feel like I'm a pervert. I think of myself as a visionary with the ability to not see things as they appear. To me, it's all about the wonder of the gears, the bearings, and housing, and seeing it all come together and working perfectly. In my head, I saw a vision. It was set in the future. The world was predominantly women. There were a few men, but most were sick with disease. I saw a place where women could go to have pleasure. It was safe, disease-free, and they could stay there as long as they wanted until they were satisfied." And this is a note this guy sent me. And I just thought it was like, it kind of like he, maybe because it was email, he could be more forthright or something. But it spelled out everything. It almost like this planet where there was no competition, there was no other men, you know. Him and his machines could have all the women. And I think it just kind of got at what made the guy tick, you know. And that was the stuff I kind of wanted to get into, you know, here. No. The man who wrote me that note, in the end, never let me photograph him. But this guy had an equally outlandish story to tell that we'll save for later. But this guy, you know, I came to photograph him, and he's in his, you know, garage where he's making this machine, and I was like, "Okay, let's do a picture of you." And he was like, "I got to go in and get changed." And I was like, "Well, what do you want to get changed for?" And he's like, "Well, I'm the president of I got to put on a suit. You know, I'm a president of this company. And, you know, this is what I want to wear." And at the time, I was like, "Oh, come on, don't do that." And then I was, when I took the picture, I was like, "Oh, that was great. You know, like, that's exactly what I wanted." And I didn't know, you know. Let's go to the next. And this is the same inventor here. And this guy, his name was Eric Wilson, and he had a company in Ohio that he called the Love Locker. And I think he meant it to sound like sweet or something like that, but it always sounded kind of weird to me, like Love Locker, you know, like like a sweaty locker or something like that for love. And so around the time I was trying to photograph him, and it was more like I talked to him on the phone and I thought he had a lot of passion, so I wanted to visit him. But his actual machine, which is the machine he was holding in the previous photograph, it wasn't that interesting, but I thought his story was interesting. And so around the time I'm trying to reach him, I'm on eBay, and there's like a mature audiences section of eBay. And I see this chair that looks like it was in a prop from Lord of the Rings or something like that. And this is what it was. It was this throne-like chair with a penis, motorized penis that came up from the bottom. And I realized it was the same guy. You know, it was this like Eric Wilson who was selling this thing. And I was like, if you sell that thing before I get out there and photograph you, you know, this whole thing is canceled. You know, like this would be the shot, totally. So, but he had this thing. It was like a one-off invention. You know, he had goofy names for these things that were also like kind of passionate and romantic. I think this one he never actually got around to naming. There's something about the throne or something like that. But let's go on to the next shot. Now, this is an early picture I made where I thought that it was kind of an inventor who started to communicate with me from Texas, and it was when I realized I needed to kind of find someone who would let me into their home. This is the first guy who did that, and he did appear in other photos. You know, he was pretty open, but this photo, I think I just loved it without a person, where it was like, you know, here are the two coffee pots, and here's the Tweety Bird, you know, cookie jar, and here's the report cards on the refrigerator, and then there's this dark black thing, you know, that was just looks like, you know, it kind of looks like a piece of art, but it kind of looks a little too functional, and you know, just I thought it was all right there, you know, and that was a kind of wait, what was that?
It looks like the Church of Cock.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, in the home environment or something. But This guy, his name was, he had kind of a fictional name, Sartan. But I got the quote, as I interviewed him, yeah, Sartan. He kind of had this kind of quote that kind of fits this. He says, "The popular image of the adult industry, or anything sexual in general, has dark rooms and black curtains and kind of grungy, nasty people behind it. People not in touch with the emotional factor. And it's so not true. Look at us. Look at my wife and I. We're your average neighbors. We mow our lawn. We feed our kids healthy food. We go to school meetings. I guess we are the perverts of the world. We could be next to you in the supermarket." And, I thought his quote was great. And when I started the project, I got to admit that I was kind of inside laughing at these people a little bit, as in someone who, like, takes sex so seriously, or they were, like, just putting all this effort into making this, like, fabricated thing. And I think I probably thought, out of ignorance, that these people would be kind of, like, had separated the emotional aspect out of, anything sexual. And I think meeting these people made me realize that, no, that wasn't the case. These people aren't caricatures. They're real people, and these are, real lives. Let's go to the next shot. This guy's kind of famous, Rick Van Thiel. Famous, like, in the world of people who invent sex machines. But he's in Henderson, Nevada. He's outside of Las Vegas. What's that?
What's his name?
Oh, Rick Van Thiel. No, not Vin Diesel. No. But, I mean, he's got this body that, he's just working out constantly, and this kind of physique that's intense. And then his machine kind of looked like him a little bit. It was this kind of hard... yeah. Hard, muscular, mechanical thing. And he had a storefront. And in the next picture, we'll see. This was like, let's try to focus this a little bit. They had, in his storefront, there's like a demo room. And so you're interested in a machine, you can go practice, you try it out in this demonstration room. And this is the room, and it was pink and blue, and then there was a can of Planters peanuts there. And this, like, butterfly sheet and, a fluorescent light. And, running this business was Rick Van Thiel, and then his wife, who's in the next photograph. And his wife is Christy Van Thiel. And I think Rick was 40-something and Christy was 20, but, in the office, there's little post-it notes that say, "I love you" with a smile face, And so, I mean, they were totally kind of affectionate and adorable together. And so I interviewed them separately, and they didn't really have any problems. Even I could have interviewed them in front of each other, and they would have been just as honest. But, Rick is the guy who's talking about, his machine could outfuck any other machine, And I was just like, well, how would that be tested? And he's like, I'll take him on anywhere. And it was just like, well, like, what kind of competition would this be, But, he was kind of gung-ho and very competitive about this sex machine thing. And then his wife here, Christy, she goes, I don't really get this machine thing and this swinging thing that Rick is into. Rick is a swinger, and it's something I need to respect, but it's not something that's for me. I feel that if you find somebody, one person, you click emotionally, sexually, and you have a good friendship, that should be enough. Now, Rick, he's always talking to me about variety, but he's really patient with me on this. And then there's these machines. I'm just not into them. I like the real thing. I like squeezing, hugging, cuddling, just holding each other. It was hard enough for me to get comfortable selling someone a dildo, much less these giant machines. But after a while, it's just like everything else. So it's almost like she was just real grounded about the thing, and they were, kind of in harmony together. So this was in Minneapolis. And this was a guy who, I communicated with him via email, and it was always very cryptic and, I put all this time trying to get people comfortable with me, talking to him on the phone and trying to send these elaborate emails that humanized myself. And with him, it was always like one-note emails, like, can I come by? Yes. Can I photograph your machine? No. And his email was something creepy, too. It was like, James comes hard at 69 at hotmail.com or, like every obscene thing that, the email could be twisted into was his. And, I was afraid to kind of go over there at night, and so I was like, meet me Saturday morning. If I can come over Saturday morning, let's do it. And he's a total sweetheart of a guy, and it was him and his girlfriend. And they were like, you can, photograph our machine, but not us. And this is so I go over and there's no machine, and I'm like, machine, you know, I'm here to photograph the machine. It's a tiny apartment. There's no machine. And he's like, oh, we got to set it up. And he like takes all these like pipes and everything out of the closet. And next thing you know, this thing is dominating the entire room. And it's just like massive. And, you know, all the while I'm running a tape recorder and they're both talking at me like crazy. And it's just kind of disorienting. And later I went to edit the tapes and I focused his like interview down to this one little piece. And he goes, the Husqvarna, which is pictured here, has a $300 KitchenAid mixer motor inside it. We thought it was silly to spend $300 on something you only use once. So we made this detachable. So if you wanted to make cookies, you can detach the mixer from the machine, hook it to its original base and bowl, clean it off, of course, and you can get to work in the kitchen. We are not kidding. And, yeah, and that was their dog. Yeah, it's pretty outlandish.
I love
that. Yeah, and it's like that earlier photo that we showed in the series that was done at CyberNet, where it's like, yeah, you open up the thing and there is this, like, black, beautiful, totally brand new, right off the shelf mixer, you know, in there. I think they liked the hard case, you know, and the kind of macho look of the thing, you know.
Yeah.
Are
they just really tall?
No, you know what they did is I think they were showing me like they were showing me every position that it could do, and I think I liked it when it was just dominated the room. So I was like, yeah, leave it like that, you know, like I like it just like that.
So that's their logo bumper sticker.
Oh, is that where they get how they got that? Oh, do you know him? He's totally totally up front. His name is Charger Pony. It's like a nickname, but move on. Okay. Oh, okay. Yeah, probably. No, a small community there, I think. Let's go to the next slide. This guy was in Boise, Idaho, and he kind of had this like metalworking place that he kind of worked in and lived in, and he was just kind of this real sincere guy. And in the book, his story kind of goes on and on and on, and I won't really get into it here, but there was just something where I thought he just looked like he was like from American heartland, you know, or something. And then in the next slide, there's his machine. And so obviously inspired by the bicycle. And there's some hunting overtones here. Yeah, looking through the sights there. We'll just move on. I'll let you guys read it in the book. So, this was in Minneapolis again. And, what was the name of this machine? It was called, like, the... it's been so long since I, you know, kind of cracked open or talked about these pictures. The thing, let me see if I have it here, because it's just a crazy name. But this is in Minneapolis. This guy's name is Scott E. Halt, and he just had this massive machine here that originally I went over his house to photograph a different machine that was a little kind of prettier. But he was like, you got to see my old machine. My first machine is really what I think you're going to like. And so I'm like, well, where is your first machine? And he's like, well, it's at my friend's house. So I'm like, okay. And so Scott and I go across town, you know, it was like 2 degrees out, really snowy and icy. And we go to his friend's house. And here, you know, this is Scott, and he's kind of like the quintessential, you know, speed-driven biker dude, you know. And, you know, clearly had not slept for days and had been up and stuff. And so he and I go... Suddenly, we find ourselves in this like totally normal suburban neighborhood, like the Brady Bunch would live in. And you know, I'm like, Scott, is that really where your friend lives? He's like, yeah, no problem. And so we knock on the door of the house, and like a normal guy answers the door, and then his wife peeks over, and you could tell the wife is not happy to see Scott, you know. And then they close the door for a little bit, and then they whisper, and then just like the guy comes out, and he leads us to the garage. And, you know, there's some mumbling about, like, it's over there by the skidoo, you know, or the like, one of these things that allows you to, like, Yes, go over the snow. And so we take this tarp off, and there's like a skidoo or whatever the thing's called, and then here's this thing. And Scott's like, you're going to have to help me with this. And it's like it took two of us, you know, all our strength to throw it into the back of this truck, you know, two men easily, you know, to move this thing. It was massive. It weighed a ton. And then we brought it back to his house, and I knew this was the photo, you know, I wanted to make, you know, of it right there on his kitchen table. And so I'll read you a little note from Scott here during the interview. He said, I always felt good about building things. I think I got it from my dad. It started with Legos, then Lincoln Logs, then it got real with the Erector set. I've built houses, I've built machines, but I've never built a business. The learning curve is steep. We were planning a spam mail campaign to promote this machine with 20 million email addresses, but unfortunately the spammer ended up in prison. He says, I'm not bisexual in any way, shape, or form. I'm strictly about the pussy. But this machine is good for any person I can think of. Gay men, closet cases, couples who aren't having sex, couples enhancing their sex life. Renting it out to the women's prison is another idea I was thinking of. So he was just trying to figure out why he couldn't, like, how to overcome the loophole, you know, of getting the thing to the women's prison, and then, you know, all the doors would be opened. Let's go to the next one. This was also in Idaho. You know, all these machines, all these inventors, they were in these tiny towns. Like, no one was in San Francisco. No one was in Los Angeles. It was all, like, you fly to the airport, and then you drive 3 hours, and then you stay in the Holiday Inn, then you meet the guy at the 7-Eleven, and then you go to his house. And, you know, it was always that, you know, far, far away, and, you know, lots of traveling. But this was a guy, John Traven was his name, in Boise, Idaho. And I saw his machine that looked exactly like this on eBay. And he had this note that said that he made it for his wife and she filed for divorce before he could present it to her. And yeah, totally touching. You know, like he's trying to use whatever skills he has to help the relationship and it just didn't work. And this photo I always liked, the couch just looked like a relationship or a failed relationship or a potential relationship or something, just this kind of, you know, two-seated white, you know, couch there and the machine. And let's go to the next shot, and this is John, and that's him. And he goes, here I am, this divorced Christian guy, not promiscuous at all, and here I am with a sex machine. It was an idea I came up with in the last year or two of the marriage as a last-ditch attempt to save whatever we had, our sex life, if nothing else. She actually pushed me for a divorce before I could finish it and give it to her. And so then he kind of explained to me, like, kind of why he thought it was relevant, you know, for him to be kind of making this machine and how it kind of opened doors for him, you know, to help other people and how he thought it was kind of a benevolent thing. And so he's kind of telling how he wants to market the thing. And he's like, so I really want to sell it to a couple. I was a virgin when I got married, and I think sex outside marriage is destructive. But if a married couple wants something I can build to add enjoyment to the relationship, I'm there and I'm open to building more for them. I will require anyone ordering a machine from me to provide proof of marriage and a signed statement of intent to use only within that marriage. Kind of like a gun dealer that requires proof of age and proof of passage of firearm safety tests before selling someone a firearm. So this guy selling the machine on eBay wants to see your marriage license before he's going to sell it to you. And yeah, I just thought it was kind of touching and kind of real, and he was standing up for, you know, what he believed in. Oh, in the back one? Yeah, go back to that one. Yeah, like that's the living room. Yeah, it was great. It was all right there, and it's just like you walk in, and it's like, oh, don't move a thing. I think we got the shot, you know. What, messy house? Yeah. Women don't dig that. Yeah, perhaps inventing the vacuum would have been better. Let's go to the next one. Yeah, let's go to the next one. So then there's this other guy, and who he was on one of these listservs, you know, machine-oriented listservs, and he was just posting these pictures of these, like, outlandish kind of sex parties with these machines and these young-looking girls, in this house that kind of looked like it had Ethan Allen furniture in it, like really old-fashioned furniture. And I sent a guy a note, and it was like, what are you doing? You know, he was like, I was like, are you a swinger, or what are you doing? You know, and he was like, well, come on out and see, you know. And he pretty much laid out that he was a voyeur, and he ran an ad in the newspaper paying girls to come over and use his machines. And he would videotape them and just kind of hang out with them. And that eventually they all became buds and just liked hanging out there anyhow. And so this is what he told me. And my job wasn't really to blow the lid off anybody's scene. You know, it was just to kind of take an oral history or something, you know. And so, you know, I spent a weekend there with him and his friends. And we'll just go through the shots here. I thought it was kind of gross and kind of pretty and swan-like all at the same time. You know, because we published the book, we had to get everybody's IDs and we had to get like everything done and stuff like that. And she was 19. The other girl was 20. And then there's another one you'll see who's 22. And I've stayed in touch with these people. Just with a book, you can't mess around. You got to get it all lined out. And so it's kind of like I've stayed in touch with these people. She just had a kid a couple years ago around the same time I had one of my other kids. So she's a mom now. And she was someone who was like kind of just... Supposedly she was there for an audition for his future website, which never, of course, got off the ground. But she was kind of the one person that I was like, what are you doing with the rest of these people? You know. And subsequently, years after, I was like, what were you doing there at that house? And she was like, oh, it's just something I wanted to try. You know. So, but I thought something looked kind of elegant about that photograph and the way she held that cigarette, the paint in the room. Let's go to the next shot. Yeah, and I just thought that girl was beautiful, and that was the Ethan Allen furniture. And then, you know, in doing the project, I was trying to get as many people as I could, you know, like, and I felt like I had all these divorced guys, so I wanted these, you know, I found this young couple who had made a machine in Portland, you know, gothic kids, and they were, you know, relatively young for the project, and their machine looked like a coffin, as you can tell, and the name of the machine was Holy Fuck. Let's go to the next one. And this is Deb. This is Deb. And there was a couple, Deb and Bill. And this is Deb. And then her husband was Bill. And Bill was in a wheelchair. He was young. He was like 38. And he had MS, multiple sclerosis, and his legs stopped working. And so he couldn't work anymore. And he had always been into posting pictures of his wife naked, you know, on different listservs and, you know, having guys write in and say how much they, you know, thought she was attractive. And so finally they decided to turn it into a way to make a living. And because of his accident, you know, they got into using a sex machine as a way to have sex. And because, you know, he kind of couldn't function below the waist. And so then they kind of, you know, making lemonade, they decided to use that as like the hook to this kind of pornographic website they were trying to start, where it would be Deb, you know, photographed by her husband and in stills and videos using this machine that's here. And let's go to the next shot. And that's a kind of detail of their machine that was made by a fan of their website. He was into woodworking and stuff. Then let's go to the next one, which is of both of them. And that's them in their room that they do the filming in. It was in their basement. Deb says, doing this lets us keep our house and have a few little extra luxuries. Plus, it's great for the self-esteem. I'd never have the confidence to do this at a younger age. But now I feel great. I'll do anything. I'm not going to pretend I'm Marilyn Chambers, you know. My web name is Virginia Bell, a middle-class housewife in Woodbridge, Virginia. I'm a 51-year-old mother of two, a big woman. Just look at me. This was about acceptance of myself. When someone would say I was beautiful, I always denied it. I couldn't accept it. But now at age 51, I totally can. It made me feel good to read guys' notes about how they liked me. Yeah, you bet. And that's when Bill was doing it for free. And now they're spending money to see me. It feels great to have guys want to spend money to see me. You bet. I am shocked, but I like it. These people, I don't know what they see in me, but if they're into it, then great. And if I can make their lives happy, bring something happy to them for a little while, and they get their yayas out, that's great. I have a really good feeling about this. And that was them. And the guy, I just always thought he looked like the magician Doug Henning from the 70s. You know, he just had that smile and that mustache. And she had this beautiful face. I thought her eyes, even when she was made up and when she was not made up, just, you know, she did have this kind of charisma, and I could see it kind of driving guys crazy to some degree. Cocktail in the background there. Let's go to the next one. This guy, a lot of people know this guy. Does anybody know this guy? You know him? Oh, you know him, totally. Yeah, yeah. Who is this guy?
Alan Stein.
What's he all about?
Is that
Thrillhammer?
Yeah. Yep, that's Thrillhammer.
That's Thrillhammer.
Say that again in that accent.
Thrillhammer.
That's so Alan, you know, being so perceptive to everything, you know, I was trying to photograph him in this outlandish machine that he invented, and which is, let's move to the next slide. And that's it. And he was like, yeah, you can photograph it, but why don't you wait a while? And I was like, why? He's like, well, just wait a while. And then I didn't hear from him for a while. And then he called me back and said, okay, here's the deal. I'm installing it in a legal brothel in Nevada. And so why don't you drive up, you know, to Nevada with me, and then you can photograph me as I'm installing it in this whorehouse, which was, I guess, the Mustang Ranch. Let's see, what was it called? No, the Chicken Ranch is what it was. And it was just this total low-budge place, and he was installing this massive sci-fi Blade Runner type of, you know, machine in it, and it was just a total scene. Let's go back to Alan. Yeah, and this is like him after a long day of trying to, like, set up a computer, and there's no, you know, internet access, and just set up this elaborate machine that, you know, used the internet and computers and sex machines and a dentist chair and everything. No, it was a stuffed chicken that they had as like a mascot, you know, in the room. Yeah. Real turn on, you know. So, yeah, that's him. And let's go to the next one. I think we're almost done here. Let's see. Oh, yeah, this is the last slide. This is just one of the inventors. He had a place in New Orleans. This was his garage in New Orleans, and this later got wiped out in the big flood. It was too bad. But I just always thought it was kind of iconic, and it looked like it could have been done at any time, you know, and just like the American worker or something like that. And, you know, there's his thing. So that's it. Anybody have any questions?
So now we bring you back into the righteous.
So, okay, first question.
Were there any female builders and inventors, like Sol, not in partnership with male builders? Yeah.
When I was working on the project, I didn't find any female inventors, and I didn't find, and then all the inventors were heterosexual too. You know, like there was never, once I interviewed a guy over the phone who said he was gay and then he invented a machine, but I never saw the machine, and it didn't really fit into the same caliber of all these other things. Yeah, the machine was gay. Yeah. But the, you know, we came out with a book, and then we were doing talks at bookstores and stuff like that to promote the book, and subsequently someone did come to me once in Chicago and once in Baltimore, a different person who was a woman and a sex machine inventor was like, hey, you should have talked to my friend. And I got the idea that my friend was really her, saying that, you know, yeah, your book didn't have any women in it, and I made one. But it just seemed like the guys were the ones who were pushing this thing. I mean, and I was scraping to get everybody I could get, really, you know, so if there was someone, I would have grabbed it. But yeah, it was harder for me to find, but it just seemed like a very male thing, and the idea of like making it a business, and because everybody here, for me to reach them, had to become public to some degree, you know, trying to make money or something. Anybody else? Question?
I have a question.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think my question is about aesthetics. You have some really hot pants on. You look really good. Yeah, so I think you... I want to ask you this question, right? So, the last...
One second. I cannot see that. So... No, it's better.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much for fixing my cable. Well, it would be nice to see the last image you departed from, because I wanted to know, like, you left off with a really sexy image of a sort of a factory worker male in a factory institution. You said something that you said that was an American worker. And I'd like to hear about what's American about that worker, because I found it very erotic, that image. And I'd like to know more about that.
Should we turn off the lights so we could see this? You know, let's see. Yeah, there. You know, maybe it's because I thought of the whole project as being this like quintessentially American thing, you know, or American male thing, or that it, you know, the idea of like this American dream that you can invent something and you're going to get rich off of it, or you're going to attract the opposite sex from it, or you're going to become more attractive yourself from it, or just something like that. And I guess the whole project kind of fit into that with me. But I don't know. I thought this picture, yeah, it looked like something, you know, like, yeah, you see these pictures in factories where the sparks are flying all over the place, and here's this kind of, you know, Bruce Springsteen-esque, you know, blue jean t-shirt wearing guy. Yeah. So I don't know. Yeah. Do you think it looks American? Yeah. Yeah. I think it kind of hits some kind of working class aesthetic or something like that. You know, and if you find that hot or romantic, or, you know, then that it would fit into that. You know, probably.
I mean, I feel hot.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great. Nice. Okay. Anything else?
You want to talk again?
Okay. Hey.
I want you to talk.
Oh. Okay. What else was hot? Any of the other shots hot? Like the?
No, it's just this, you know, I mean, I'll
do it in the microphone because, well, I'm trying to be humble about it, but there's sort of this implicit, when you talk about technology in any realm, there's like an implicit sort of like default mechanism for critique, which is sort of against the industrial mode. But if you think about the man with the blue hair from Austria, last night, he was really trying to get this sort of proletarian bohemian. And I think we have to come to grips with the sexiness of proletarian consciousness and proletarian being. You know, instead of trying to overcome that, to sort of like, you know, sort of, you know, aestheticize it.
Yeah.
I think that's a very important moment for us right now politically.
Oh, interesting. Can I respond to that?
Yeah.
I'm curious if you think that technology is inherently anti-proletarian in that discourse.
Some filmmaker, huh? I don't think that technology is inherently anti-proletarian, but I think that because of the Industrial Revolution and the way that in which capitalist social relations were so conflated with the industrial mode of production that we really need to rethink the grounds of critique today. Is that fair?
Sure.
I noticed on one of the slides that you showed that there was a guy who had, you know, this amazing bookshelf that included stuff like Lego Technics and also a book on Linux. And I'm curious that did you find that there was some sort of correlation between the sort of like builders of these sex machines and their desire to share and actually having an understanding of open source and free software and other like tinkering that like in their everyday lives, like where some of these people like I don't know, what were their like actual professions and how did they relate to that and did they share in the rest of their lives in the way that they shared with you?
Yeah, that's a good question. Everybody hear that?
The Linux thing, that's interesting that you kind of grabbed onto that. That was probably an aberration rather than the norm. You know, like no real common thread. Like some of these guys, you know, had MBAs and then some, you know, were total, you know, like the you know, American, you know, working class laborer, you know, like metal worker type of guy who would not know Linux and would not, you know, I couldn't email the guy, you know, it would just be all phone calls. And so, you know, no technology. You know, that cowboy guy, you know, he was selling it on eBay, so he had used computers a little bit. No, I could not agree that there would be parallels, you know what I mean, that you're looking for, that there was that. I mean, the one thing, though, I would say is if you just want to talk about, like, them sharing their lives with me, is that I came to the project with this baggage. Like, oh my God, I'm going to go to this guy's house and interview him about his sex life, and you know, will I really ask what I want to ask? And these people, they were so well adjusted, and it was so. This was just something they always thought about and dealt with, and the idea of someone coming over to talk to them seriously about it, and there was no baggage at all. You know what I mean? The baggage was mine. You know, so they were well adjusted. I was the one who was like, you know, oh, I don't know what I should ask. You know.
Were they interested in freely sharing their schematics and these listservs? Like, were they really interested in helping improve and sort of collaborate on better ways to fuck each other?
Oh, yeah, no, that could be. Yeah, oh, I see where you're going with that. Yeah, they on the listservs and stuff, they would be like, you know, this. If you do, the competition was gone, it seems like, on these listservs. And there, they were trying to help each other figure out how to improve this thing. Or, like, what motor, you know, could you use the motor from your dishwasher for your dryer on this thing, and would it have enough revolutions per minute, or would it not be strong enough to do the thing? So, yeah, that parallel. Are you a journalist? That was pretty good. No, but that parallel, yeah, it could be made for sure. Yeah, I would say. Uh-huh.
I can, like, attach that, because we are talking about, like, the working class and stuff like that, and now you're talking about revolutions per minute or a second. Okay.
I just had a quick question. I was curious about whether these inventors have any other kinds of machines that they invent, whether you heard about other kinds of gadgets or machines.
Yeah, no, that was a good question. I think I was always going there thinking an inventor is an inventor, and of course they would have tried to do all these different things. And, you know, I think this guy right here, the previous thing he invented was, like, something that helped him pick walnuts up off the ground or something like that. Like, it had nothing to do with, and it was nowhere near as elaborate as the machines that he was inventing. And so it's kind of like I was always searching for this link that wasn't really there. It seemed like a lot of them, the first thing they ever really brought to fruition and really made on such a grand scale and in such a finished product, and then really was trying to, like, put it out there in the world was, like, their sex machine. And so that always surprised me, because I was like, wait a minute, you went from zero to this? And they'd be like, yeah, you know. And that always baffled me, because I always figured that they would be making something that had a parallel to the machine, like whatever that would be, like a weed whacker, or, you know, something that would do that, and they, like, made that, and then they, you know, found a parallel. Though, no, the one thing I would say is one of the guys, he and his wife had a baby, and they had to make a breast pump to, you know, milk, you know, bring the milk out of the wife's breast to feed the baby. And he figured out how to make this breast pump and then reconfigured the breast pump into his very first sex machine. Nice. The birth is there, and, you know, it's got all the metaphors.
White fluid.
Were they all penetrative machines, or were there any even, you know, intent to explore other types of sexual machinery? Other types of stimulant. I mean, other than just fucking machines.
Yeah. Sucking,
oh, say that again.
I said, did any of the machines actually reestablish or sort of, like, try to examine what it means to fuck, or was it all this, like, concept of, like, it is a phallus and it must enter something?
I think maybe
the latter, pretty much. You know. The one thing is, and that was a valid question. A lot of these guys did have machine attachments on the machine that would be like a sleeve, you know what I mean, that your penis would go into, so it would kind of be like a vagina. And, the one thing you got to remember is I'm a photographer, and I liked the ones that had the phalluses on it, because I thought it kind of looked like a big statue that would be somewhere in a public area and, you know, in some weird culture. Or I thought it looked so... this weird combination of mechanical and human, you know. And so that had the visual punch to me. The ones that had these sleeves on it suddenly didn't look as anthropomorphic or something like that, and I wasn't as interested in them, you know. But, wait, you had a question. What did you phrase it? Because, you know, there is this invention that it's in the book, but I didn't have it here, the Sibian machine. And the Sibian was the guy who felt like he was redefining, that's kind of like this, it's combination vibrator, you know, type of thing. And he thought that all these things were ignorant. and were made by men who didn't understand women. And exactly. And that he thought this was all the dumbed down, like, high school version of sexuality, and that his machine was the version that women would actually appreciate. And so he was a real line drawer, you know. Yeah, yeah, he's in the book. Old guy, and, you know, kind of wealthy. And if it could be believed, like, you know, he prepared for me to arrive, but he had a mini factory that had, you know, like, 80 machines, you know, being, you know, buzzing away as I was there to photograph. And I don't know if he set that up for me or if he's actually turning around that quantity, you know. And again, I never tried to push anybody for, like, how much money are you making or how successful is this, but he gave the image of being very successful, you know, whether it's true or not. I don't know.
They choreographed Esther Williams,
I believe. Yeah. Anybody else?
I have to add that Peter Acero also interviewed the guy. What's his name, the guy who...
Dave Lampert.
Dave Lampert, yeah. And in the morning, the matinee, we had this movie by Peter Acero called Love Machine, and there's this interview with the guy who created the Symbian thing.
Dave.
And that's a brilliant interview. If you haven't seen it so far, the movie, and if you haven't been there in the morning, you should get the movie. The guy sitting over there.
When did you talk to him? Like, what year? Oh, in 2000. So that was before I did. Was he mean?
So please exchange your problems with the guy.
Yeah. No, I mean, he's particular. I mean, he was sort of generous. He didn't really want to be on camera. He was really nervous to be on camera. But, yeah, I mean, he really wanted to promote his product, but didn't really want to say what the product was. He had this weird reservation about presenting himself.
Okay, because he would never consider himself like an amateur or like doing. He's like he considers himself like a real like big businessman. Or
That's exactly it. He didn't want to be shown with these people who were like he saw as hobbyists. Yeah, and I know that the people who were editing my book, they were like, "You got to have this guy in here. He's part of the history of everything. And even if he's boring, you got to try to get him in." And so I felt like he didn't need this, and I had to coerce him to try to cooperate. You know, and in the end, he seemed. He didn't sue me or anything, so I thought he accepted it. But he was the guy I feared lawsuits and stuff like that because he was so kind of controlling. Anybody else ask anything? I think we got it. Oh, okay.
Did you try any of these machines? And if so, which ones?
I tried them all.
That's why he's doing.
Yeah.
Camera, we got pictures?
Yes, yes, yes. Buy the book. It's in there. If anybody wants a copy of the book, I brought like 5 of them with me. But you can get them on Amazon and stuff like that. But if you want them, I got them. Yeah.
Timothy Archibald.